We have to actually receive the best depth of the past. There's got to be fundamental continuities. Let's read the sonnets deeply. And then, in response to the emergency, in response to the meta crisis, our crisis is a birth. Crisis is an evolutionary driver. We end where we began now, and we birth something entirely new, entirely emergent. And we have the joy of the radical creativity, the evolutionary impulse of cosmos literally moving through us and birthing the new, the emergent. And it's only that new emergent story of value that is threaded by continuity and discontinuity that has the capacity to be the new story and in response to the metacrisis. It's insanely great to be back with y'all. It's like insanely fantastic. So one, I want to really thank Terry Nelson, right? Who did a beautiful One Mountain a couple weeks back. And, you know, like super thank you. And to everyone who held One Mountain a couple weeks back, I want to thank Christina Amelon, right? Who led a One Mountain, a kind of report from the crossing, this major event we did in Europe about crossing from Homo sapien to Homo amor. And so Christina did a report from the crossing. And, you know, so thank you, Terry. Thank you, Christina. Right. Deep bow and to everybody, right? You know, who held those weeks so beautifully. And thank you to Dr. Elena, right? Who did the One Mountain last week on the sonnets as a kind of precursor to cosmorotic humanism. And, you know, it's worth noting two things. One is that Christina, my partner, is now framing one of Elena's paintings, right? To put it, you know, right in the office downstairs. So the sonnets, or at least the spirit of Shakespeare, is close to us. And we look forward to us all being together. We're all going to be coming together in Vermont, you know, very soon. Right. So we're super excited about that. And just one short note. The sonnets are astonishingly beautiful. And Elena has actually painted a painting for each one of the sonnets. And it's worth saying just one thing about what do we mean when we say something's a precursor, right? And so the nature of evolution is that it's one story, right? And there are what I'm going to create a word. There are long continuities in the story. Is that fair? That's a good word. Long continuities. Does everyone get that phrase? Maybe someone can jot it down. It's a nice phrase to catch. There are long continuities in the story, right? And then there are discontinuities. There are breaks, right? There are asymmetric breaks. There are minor fluctuation points that jump the system, right, to a higher level of order. So there are discontinuities. Okay, is everyone with me? Okay, this is just this is a kind of a big deal. And I'm going to cut myself off in hopefully like about 90 seconds to 2 minutes, because it's tempting just to talk about this. This is really understanding how to articulate a new story of value in response to the meta crisis, which is what we're here to do. We're here to stare the meta crisis in the face, to stare existential risk in the face, and to turn the crisis into a birth, to turn the crisis into an evolutionary driver, right? To have this state of emergency generate emergence, and to actually not turn away. That's one response to the meta crisis, to medicate, to turn away, to deny. The denial response, there's the doomer response is a second response, which is actually very prevalent in lots of internal circles. Basically, we're done. So let's start grieving. But there's actually nothing we can do to change course. And we're saying, no, it's not about denial. It's not about doomer. It's about Da Vinci. It's about a new dawn. It's about telling a new story of value in this time between worlds, in this time between stories, and that only a new story of value has the capacity to actually change the trajectory of history, because everything that we create, everything we generate is from within the context, right, of story. So when Elena talks about the, you know, the the sonnets as a precursor to cosmogonic humanism. Essentially, what she's saying correctly, and what we need to understand, is that when we say a new story of value, what we mean is we actually weave together the deepest strands, the deepest threads of validated insight. Everyone going to track with me the sentence? We weave together the deepest threads of validated insights that come from all the different ways of knowing. Does that make sense? It come from all the different ways of knowing. We look with the eye of the mind. We look with the eye of the senses. We look with the eye of the artist. We look with the eye of value. We look with the eye of consciousness. We look with the eye of the heart. We look with the eye of contemplation. And we look with the eye of the spirit. That's a number. That's a number of different eyes. And we're going to add a little bit to that essay, Kirsten Zohar, right, on multiple eyes that just appeared on Substack this week. But those are all different ways of knowing. So we weave the validated insights, stay close, from all those different eyes that emerge and are recognized and are articulated at every stage of history, in every part of the world. Everyone with us? We weave them together into a new tapestry. So weaving the sonnets, for example, into cosmogonic humanism, or weaving, let's say, Zen Buddhism, which talks about 10 oxherding pictures, and the 10th oxherding picture, right, is about the master who returns to the marketplace, right? Weaving that oxherding picture into our vision of self matters. Now stay close. That doesn't mean we want to return to a full vision of Zen Buddhism as our matrix source, nor do we want to return to Shakespeare, right, to the sonnets, right, as our ground vision. But we want to actually draw from the sonnets. We want to draw from Zen Buddhism. We want to draw from Kashmir Shaivism. We want to draw from, right, the best and most profound insights of the 11 schools of psychology. We want to see what Durkheim got right when he was talking about homo duplex, right? We want to draw from mystical Christianity. Does everyone get that? So we want to weave together, and we realize we don't want to make the New Age or fundamentalist move, which says, let's go back to some ancient wisdom, which arose in different cultural conditions, right? Which was often ethnocentric and often body denying and often confused, right? No, we don't want to do that. We don't want to go back to, but we want to draw from, right? We want to draw from the great traditions of pre-modernity. We want to draw from Shakespeare, whoever and however Shakespeare's wisdom appeared, who's kind of this deep, profound observer of the interior of humanity. And when you read the sonnets, they're elliptical and they're subtle. And we kind of step in and they speak to us. So it's a very, very profound realization. We're drawing from everywhere. And we're listening deeply. And then we're weaving that, we're synergizing that together in a new story of value. And that new story of value is both profound continuity. Does everyone get that from the ancient traditions? And it's profound discontinuity. It's radically emergent. It's radically new. Does everyone get that? It's deep, right? So in other words, today is not just the result of yesterday, right? It's not the antecedent causation yesterday determines today. On the other hand, I want to be listening deeply to yesterday, to the resonances of yesterday, and to finding the strands of the deepest resonances and then amplifying them. And then what happens is, now stay close, everyone, the past is redeemed. The past is liberated. It could be that Elena understands the sonnets better than anyone at Shakespeare's time. The sonnets might be only fully speaking their voice today, right? It's only today that they begin to find their voice. And then we weave them together, right, in this new story of value. So the past weaves into the present and creates the future. There's both radical continuities and radical discontinuities. Can everyone track that? And that's how you create a new story of value, with the radical sense of long continuities, right? And with radical discontinuities happening at the same time. And the inability to track the relationship between radical continuities and radical discontinuities actually destroys the capacity to create a shared story of value. Does everyone get that? How many people are getting that and why that matters? I just want to check in for a second, okay? And I apologize with some level of sincerity and some level of insincerity for going, you know, off on this track. But actually, it's just because it so matters, it's so important, it's a big deal. Like, can I give you an example? Everyone, who's up for an example, okay? Who's up for, anyone up for an example? Who wants an example? I'll give you a great example of this, okay? Here's a great example. So in this particular work that I'm working on now, right? I'm working on multiple tracks right now. And one of them is this thing called the phenomenology of Eros, which I worked on with my partner, Christina Kincaid. And Aubrey Marcus is kind of joining us. And it's this work that I spend, I don't know, 18 months essentially not breathing and wrote some, I don't know, 12, 15 volumes. It got a little carried away and I had fun. Okay. And in this phenomenology of Eros, I draw a distinction between the human level and the animal level. Simple human-animal distinction. Now, my editor, who's a great guy, from The New Yorker, who's a sweet, lovely, good man, and I would say kind of a subtle materialist, liberal, postmodern, in-sense thinker. And Kevin, if you're listening, hey, nothing personal. I love you mad, right? So he sends me this long note saying, Mark, are you not tracking the research these days, right? Don't you know, you know, that there's this explosion of research in the animal world where we now basically realize that animals went and they kind of unpacked, you know, other subtle dimensions. They didn't go down our particular dimension of capacity, but they have all these other capacities and this notion of kind of a hierarchy between humans and animals, but that's like out of date. Okay. You know, and of course, you know, he implicitly invoked what's called speciesism, right? This notion that I would somehow prefer human beings, right, in some way. Now, let's go slow for a second. I want to get this. This is deep. So on the one hand, it's actually true. I have tracked animal studies over the last 13, 14 years. My friend Sean Esbjørn Hargens, right, has done some really good work here in collating and integrating, right, that world of studies. Right, I've looked at it independently as well, and probably looked at, I don't know, 15, 20 studies probably in the last 2 years. It's a little sideline, okay? And it's absolutely true that there are a list of dimensions which we said, those are only human. Those things, you know, culture, humor, right? There's a whole set of issues we said, you know, or kind of demarcating lines, which we said only exist in the human world. And now study after study is disclosing that we have versions of those precise human characteristics that begin earlier in the animal world. Besides having an entire range of animal capacities that human beings, right, don't have access to, right? And yet, right, and it's of course true that human beings have a very strong animal dimension. We include the animal in a strong way. So there is actually, now stay close, I want you to get this. There is actually a much more profound continuity between the human and the animal world than, for example, Descartes could have ever imagined. Descartes thought that the animals were essentially soulless and therefore could be treated with great cruelty, right? That actually, right, is incorrect. And the lineage of Solomon, for example, right, has an esoteric book which talks about the unique song of every animal, the unique music of every animal. There's actually a much more profound continuity between the animal world and the human world. So there's a long continuity. Is everyone getting that? And yet, there's also a discontinuity, right? In other words, it's also quite clear that there is a momentous leap of a particular kind of emergence. We call that the third Big Bang, right? The third Big Bang, right? This movement from, right, the height and depth and subtlety of human life, right? Excuse me, of animal life, where we enter into the depth of the human self-reflective mind, an entirely new set of capacities come on board, right, that actually are referred to in the lineages as Homo Imago Dei, right? This unique spark, creative, right, intelligence of a particular kind, right, which develops a new set of interior qualities, right, that are distinct and unique, right? It's a big deal, right? And now I'm going to say something which can get everybody mad. Everyone ready to get mad? Who's ready to get mad? Everybody ready? Just tell me if you're ready to get mad. I mean, like half of the people get mad. Are you ready? Come on. Come on. Go for it. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. We can get mad. It's fine. It's totally good. Okay. Here we go. Ready? So if your neighbor is drowning, right? And a dog is drowning at the same time, and you only have time to save one, who do you save? So I'm going to answer the question. You save your neighbor. Sorry. Okay. Who's mad? You can get mad. You save your neighbor, right? Right? It's a big deal though. Okay. That's a big deal. I want you to get this. Who do you save? S-A-V-E. Who do you save? Right? You save the human being. Right? That's actually true. And that's a very big deal, right? And it's like, it's a very, very, very big deal. Okay. That matters. That doesn't mean the dog doesn't have interiority and the dog doesn't have intelligence. The dog doesn't have beauty. And the dog might be a man or a woman's best friend. And we also, right, do need to save that human being first in that situation. That's a big deal. At the same time, we have this recognition that one of the great tragedies of today, which we need to atone for and shift immediately, is the way we approach the animal world. And we need to approach the animal world with depth, with reverence, with stewardship, with listening, right? With openness, right? With a kind of sense of the sacred. That's all completely true. Does everyone get that? That's all completely true, right? In other words, and factory farms, right, are a horror of human abject cruelty rooted in Descartes and other sources, right, that we need to atone for in some very, very, very profound way. Does everyone get that? Right, you know, and there is something called Homo Imago Dei. And Homo Imago Dei, right, this notion of there's a distinct emergent called humanness is unbelievably important. Stay close, friends. So this relationship between long continuities is very hard for people to hold, right? This paradox is actually one of the demarcating characteristics of a person's actual structure of consciousness, the ability to hold this paradox. Our hearts are in reverence, right? In devotion, right? In service to the animal world, right? We need to atone for the horrific violations of that service. We need to see the long continuities. We need to read the research very carefully in which the kind of sacred texts of the lineages and the shamanic texts, which understood something of the depth and the beauty of the animal world, are now being, right, actually aligned with, right, in very, very beautiful ways, right, in the sciences, you know, and we need to actually recognize it's actually correct that there are three big bangs. We actually do go, there is matter. Right? There is matter. There is then from matter, we do move into life. And from life, we do move into the depth of the self-reflective human mind. One is foundational to the other. One includes and transcends. The human being includes dimensions of the animal, not all the dimensions. There's any number of capacities of the animal that don't live in the human being. And animals have unique capacities, unique paths that they've developed that don't live in the human being. Whales have capacities, dolphins have capacities, dogs have capacities, the human beings don't, right? And there is, right, a plot line of evolution. There are new capacities in evolution. So human beings, right, who make tragic mistakes and who do terrible things. Genghis Khan was bad, right? But there is a notion called the evolution of love. There's a notion called the evolution of culture and consciousness. Human beings do build hospitals for the weak. Human beings do hold ethical visions, right, that actually potentially include everyone. Human beings do have the capacity to move from egocentric intimacy to ethnocentric intimacy, to world-centric intimacy, to cosmocentric intimacy in a way that would appear to be profound and unique and distinct. That's a very, very big deal. And I want to ask everyone just, you know, it's very easy to be reactive. Just kind of drop in for a second. Drop in beneath the reaction and find your depth, right? Find your depth. It's, you know, how do we feel and how do we think? We've got to find our depth and kind of step in beneath reactivity and actually feel the truth of this. It's very deep, right? It's very, very deep. It's long continuities and and profound discontinuities. And it's the paradox between continuities and discontinuities that allows us to create a whole. And essentially, you have today in the world two schools. There are those who argue only for continuities, right? Only continuities. And there's no essential momentous leaps, right? There are no symmetry breaks, right? It's all one continuity, right? And anyone who would prefer in any way and who would kind of give any priority of any kind and who would suggest any kind of hierarchy of any nature between the human and animal is a speciesist, right? Who is somehow deplorable, right? To say the least. So the incapacity to make distinctions, right? The leveling of differences, right? The incapacity to make distinctions, the incapacity to see what my friend Rhianne Eisler, the feminist, called holistic hierarchies, and to distinguish between holistic hierarchies and dominator hierarchies, right? This movement to level all differences, to erase distinction, right? Is a subtle materialism. It's a subtle reductionism. At the same time, the positing of radical symmetry breaks without long continuities, right, is the source of dogmatism, the source of oppression, and the source of tyranny, and the source of cruelty, right? That's true both in the human world in forms of racism and anti-Semitism, and, you know, we go down the list, right? And it's true in the relationship between humans and animals. So the capacity is very subtle, my friends, right, to hold continuities. Does that make sense? Right, tender, right? Continuities and discontinuities at the same time. Okay, so is anyone up for one more example of this? Right, one more example. Who's up for one more example? What the hell, right? Who's up? We up for one more example? Because this is like its core. And just to know, right? I in the middle of the night I sat and wrote myself a bunch of notes of what I want to talk about today. But this is just so important. Can we do just another like 3 minutes on this? Okay, just 3 minutes, just to get this. It's so important. Right. And again, anyone who's upset we're doing this topic, you know, blame Elena. Okay. So she's going to be handling that. That's anyone has any ire about that, just direct that at Elena, you know, sonnets, right? Right. She can hold that, right? Elena, can you hold that? It's okay. We're good. I'll handle that. We got that. Good. Here we go. So I'll give you another example. Let's talk about something like Eros itself. Okay. Love itself. So when we talk about love or Eros existing at the level of the subatomic world, right? You know, when protons, neutrons, and electrons, Simona and Emil, right? It's not just protons and neutrons. Proton and neutrons begin their relationship right after the Big Bang, but then electrons come into the mix, and then the proton, neutron, electron mix in a particular way coheres 380,000 years later in what's called an atom. Right, and what's called an atom, which is a new coherence, right, which is sparked by, right, a cooling, which allows for new attractive forces, new forces of allurement, etc. Right, this new coherence called an atom. And when we talk about those forces of allurement that generate an atom, and we talk about that as the early force of Eros in reality, right, we talk about that, which actually begins at the inception perspective of physics. Right, autonomy and communal already in play, right, at the very, very inception, right, the very beginning, first nanoseconds, you already have, right, proto dimensions of autonomy and communion. You have these values that play in cosmos. But that doesn't mean that that quality of Eros or love that lives in the subatomic world, in the world of, right, the electrons, right, the two lovers of the proton, as Emil likes to say, right, had, and Emil studied with me for many years, and he's kind of gotten this idea of the universal love story, right? So he just wrote me a beautiful letter about the proton and its two lovers, right? The neutron and electron. And Simona wrote me my Italian professor friend wrote me another, right, long series of texts, like three texts last night about the proton, neutron, electron world, right? So when we talk about love and Eros animating that world, that doesn't mean that Talia, who just left a comment, and her husband Shmuel, and Talia and her five kids, that the nature of that interior relationship between Talia and her family is the same interior quality, right, as protons, neutrons, and electrons. That would be absurd, right? There's clearly a discontinuity, right, between protons, neutrons, and electrons and their interiority and the nature of their allurement, right? And Talia's allurement to her children and her husband, obviously, right? And just to be clear between us for a second, this is just between us. Please don't share this. I happen to be madly in love with dogs, right? It's a hidden story. We don't want to go into it, right? But I love dogs. And just between us, I've never dated a dog. Don't share that with anyone. I've been accused of many things, but you know, bestiality never made it on the list. Okay, right? And I don't date dogs, but I never did. When I was in high school, I really loved dogs, but I never asked one on a date. Isn't that weird? But I love dogs. How could that possibly be? Well, because, right? You know, that's right. Now, at the same time, the quality of allurement, right, that exists between me and my puppy, right, or cat, or you and your animals, right, is actually there's a spectrum, there's a continuity between that and our love between our human friends. And the quality of allurement, right, that defines the evolution of the subatomic world into the atomic world, the molecular, the macromolecular, right? And then the intensifying of intimacies, right, that actually generate, right, in some sense, life, which is a whole conversation, right? But those intimacies, those allurements actually run through cosmos and they evolve. Does that make sense? So Eros is real. Love is real, but we use the word Eros because we're not talking about local love, and there's an evolution of love. So there are continuities and discontinuities. So there's a coherence to the story. Does that make sense, everyone? So it's a great example, right? So you have, right. And there are people whose deepest relationship is with their dogs. That's absolutely true. I'm completely aware of that. KK, Christina, my partner on a bad day reminds me that might be true of her. No, that's not true. And it's like, I like my, right? But no, that's right. That is true. That is true. And let's get really clear. And yes, I have a deep and subtle relationship with my dog. And right, the overwhelming majority of humanity, right, would prefer at least the possibility, right, of exchanging interior communion with another human being, right? And there can be enormously profound and subtle relationship, right, with a dog or a cat that's of unimaginable beauty, right, and which in particular ways can even exceed certain qualities that we have with a human being. Helps that they're not talking, right? But again, there's depths of possible love, but that are very, very real. That's all true. This is what I mean. So let's embrace continuities and discontinuities. This is a very good litmus test. Are you thinking well? And are you actually cohering, right, a new story of value that's real? You have to be able to actually embrace continuities, see continuities where actually religion and dogma saw only discontinuities. Descartes saw only discontinuities between the human world and the animal world. Right? Is that true? Is that true, everybody? Descartes saw only discontinuities between the human and the animal world, the human and the animal world. We need to be able to see both continuities and discontinuities, knowing full well that we ourselves don't have access, right, to the full interiority, right, of dogs. That's obviously true. That's obviously true, right? Obviously, right? Right? We've at least in this incarnation, no one's ever been a dog, right? So we don't have full access to the interiority of dogs. And, you know, Christina loves watching the movies where the dogs are talking about what's actually going on. Could be, right? You know, and there's a reason why dogs don't build hospitals for sick dogs. Dogs do occasionally take care of a sick dog, occasionally, that's out of their family. Not usually, though. Not usually, if you study the literature, right? But human beings actually have this ideal of building hospitals, right? For every other human being on the face of the planet, right? That's like, wow, that's a big deal. And we look at Genghis Khan now, and we say that Genghis Khan was a gross violation of actually how we now understand value, because value has evolved. But we wouldn't say that we want to stop fish from eating each other. That'd be a strange thing to say. We wouldn't say we want to actually stop the ecosystem of the jungle. We wouldn't say that. We would say, right? We would say that we want human beings, and there's a very strong vision among, you know, at least a couple of billion people on the planet, which is about world-centric and ultimately cosmocentric consciousness, which human beings need to treat each other a certain way. And that vision is very strong. And we can even extend that to animals, that human beings need to treat animals in a certain way. That's a big deal. That's a big deal. So again, right? This is, you know, we're doing kind of like a training in thinking today and feeling, right? How do I feel the animal world? How do I feel the continuity? And how do I actually feel the discontinuity? Okay, now let me go one more step. So I want to go back to how do we actually allow ourselves to evolve? So can I just share something with you? Just kind of, is that okay? Just from my teacher self. Okay, I have a little teacher self like over there. Okay, so teacher self. Okay, here's a teacher self thing. So whenever I'm excited about a new dimension of the story of value, right? And I'll share it, let's say for the first time, there will be a whole bunch of people who are great people. They'll say, oh, right. We know that. And they'll fit it into some earlier system. And say, oh, you're saying that. Does everyone recognize what I'm talking about? Happens all the time. And I've said to students for the last, you know, 40 years, right? I started teaching, 44 years ago. That's a little embarrassing. Okay. You know, I'm 93. I look a little young for my age, right? But I started teaching about 44 years ago. Okay. Right. And I've tried to consistently say for these last, you know, few decades, whenever there's some deep new emergent idea, don't translate it into an old idea. Get that there's an emergence here. Right. And I've tried the last decades to work in birthing these emergents, feel the emergent, right? Feel the emergent. Okay. Feel the emergent, right? There's an emergent. And let's go back to the sonnets and see in the sonnets what are seeds of cosmorotic humanism that both illuminate the sonnets of Shakespeare, then the sonnets of Shakespeare can then illuminate dimensions of cosmorotic humanism. Does everyone get that? It's very subtle, but it's a very, very important dharma. And it was not my intention to do this dharma with you at all today, but it's an important one. So let's call this. And we call this in cosmorotic humanism, and hold on, where is this? Oh, I promised myself today not to forget. Okay, here we go. Don't remember this book? Okay, now a key thing with this book, First Principles and First Values, one of the key ideas in this book is the principle of continuity and discontinuity. So the point that we're making here is, let's see if we can kind of capture. This is the last example, but it's a fantastic, insanely great example. Okay, ready? So the reason that value theory fell apart, because value theory pointed to discontinuities. Does everyone get that sentence? Let me say it again. The reason value theory fell apart, and everyone said value is not real, is because value theory in modernity and in postmodernity pointed to discontinuities and value. And value theory could not see what I'm calling long continuities. So stay close for a second. We've talked about this in different ways, but so value theory said, huh, you talk about love? Love looked this way 2000 years ago, right? Right, and I always give the same example, right? Your child's disobedient, right? You're supposed to put him to death, right? But you actually just break his arm, because if he was disobedient in a particular way, he's actually supposed to be killed. But you love your child so much, you just break his arm because you're such a loving father. Today, you should be reported for abuse and you should go to prison probably, you know, for violence against your child. But 1500 years ago, 2000 years ago, they called that love. Today we call it abuse. The point, there's such a discontinuity in how we use the word love that value or love as a real value, love being real or love being a value of cosmos is a crock. It's not true. Value is not real. So value theory points to discontinuities and says, value is not real. Stay for a second. Fundamentalism says there's got to be complete continuity. Fundamentalism says there's only continuity without evolution. Fundamentalism says, right, there's only eternity, continuity, the eternal Tao, complete continuity, and any break in continuity is heresy. Does everyone get that sentence? Any break in continuity is heresy. Same thing. It's got to be the same thing again and again and again. Because if a value is eternal, Fundamentalism mistakes the word eternal for being unchanging. They say eternal means unchanging, and therefore the continuity means there's no breaks. Does everyone get that? Wow. So you got fundamentalism saying only continuity. You've got postmodern and postmodern value theory saying only discontinuity. The whole point of this book, there's first principles and first values in cosmos, and they're evolving first principles and first values. I'm excited. Anybody excited with me? You see how beautiful it is? There's evolving, not just, right? There's evolving first principles and first values. So eternal doesn't mean unchanging. Eternal means there's a quality of essence that's beneath time space. Beneath the time space continuum, there's a quality of essence. Value is intrinsic. Right? Value is not hard to find. Value is impossible to avoid. We live in what we call, right, in cosmorotic humanism, a field of value. And we actually have a capacity for valueception. There's an eye of value. We can see, we can perceive value. Does everyone get that? And value evolves, right? So this, for within this continuity of value in the field of value, value then deepens. There's an evolution of love. Right? There's an evolution of value. So there's both a continuity and meaning. And I'm going to add something, okay? There's a continuity and meaning. Love means caring for, nurturing, supporting, right? Having some feeling for. And how that applies and plays and manifests evolves. So there's an evolution of love. So for example, just one example, okay? Right? So do I love only in my life as a modern person? Do I love only my inner circle, egocentric love? Or but I don't really love, I won't sacrifice for anyone outside of my circle. Or do I actually have a larger love for, wow, my whole community? I love everybody in One Mountain, Many Paths. And all the people that hang in our whole community, we love each other. We actually have a palpable feeling of love, although it expresses differently. Or do I love every human being, but we leave the animals out? Because that's a radical discontinuity. Or do we include the animals and do we then just even include the cosmos? I have this massive love of cosmos, and there's a value structure that moves throughout cosmos, right? So love evolves. So love is real, it's eternal, there's continuity, and there's discontinuity. So that's a big deal. So there's a plot line, there's a thread, and the thread actually expresses itself in the creative advance of novelty. That's what Alfred North Whitehead writes in Process and Reality and other places. And it's core to evolutionary theory. It's core to the lineage of Solomon. There's newness. There's emergence. Does everyone get that? There's emergence. Wow. 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 Wow, right? Wow, it's deep. Does everyone get that this is deep? It's like this is deep. This is deep. Can we do one last image? Right? That's right, Josh. Something never seen before, something completely emergent, and yet something completely rooted, right? In the profundities and potencies of the past. I'll just give you one last image, okay? Because you know it's always good to invoke a third century Aramaic text, right? Why not? Okay. So there's this dude y'all might be familiar with who kind of makes major appearances as Charlton Heston in the movies like 40, 50 years ago. But you know, has major influence in the Arab and the Hebrew and the Christian world. His name is Moses. And Moses has this mystical vision. He's doing a medicine journey, right? With my friend Aubrey. Moses and Aubrey doing a little medicine journey. And Moses sees this vision, right, of this master named Akiva, who lives like 1400 years after Moses. And Akiva is this massive master, this master of Eros, and this master of law, and this master of text, and this master of humanness, and this master of practice. And Moses, in his mystical medicine journey vision, says, if a human being like that exists, he says to this in this archetypal tale, he says, if a human being like that exists, why, God, are you giving wisdom through me? Give it to that human being. And so in this medicine journey, this divine angelic, you know, kind of force takes Moses into the kind of the zendo, if you will, right? The study hall of Akiva. And Moses is dazzled by Akiva's goodness and his integrity and his brilliance and his wisdom. And he's kal shadate, it says in Aramaic. He feels like, right, like, wow, like, what does this have to do with the Torah that I gave? Moses says, I shared this Torah 1400 years ago, and this is the lineage. This is the chain of continuity, right? I've passed on this Torah, has been passed on from generation to generation. And now I'm getting to Akiva, and I don't understand a word that he's talking about. So where's the continuity? It's all discontinuity. It's like this entirely new world, something, Josh, you wrote something entirely new, right? Does everyone get that? And then someone asks Akiva, right? This later master, they ask Akiva a question, right? And Akiva says, ah, halacha la Moshe Sinai. I've derived that from the great principle and insight of Moses. And Moses breathes a sigh of relief, not because his ego has been quieted or salved or appeased, because Moses in that moment grasps the fundamental evolutionary principle of continuity and discontinuity. Right? That's how we have to create lineage today. We need to create a new story of value. We can't do it by harking back to an imagined past, right? I really don't believe there's value, but I make up a truth about some old Russian empire or some old Catholic hierarchy or some old Jewish vision of the temple or some old, right, Buddhist, Tibetan Buddhist vision. We go backwards. That's called a regression. We have to actually receive the best depth of the past. There's got to be fundamental continuities. Let's read the sonnets deeply. And then, in response to the emergency, in response to the meta crisis, our crisis is a birth. Crisis is an evolutionary driver. We end where we began now, and we birth something entirely new, entirely emergent. And we have the joy of the radical creativity, the evolutionary impulse of cosmos literally moving through us and birthing the new, the emergent. And it's only that new emergent story of value that is threaded by continuity and discontinuity that has the capacity to be the new story and in response to the meta crisis. Like, wow, right? Okay. So first, a sincere apology. This was not my intention to talk about this today. Two, we've already established that the blame for this is with Elena, not with me. And if we can, we're going to do just this very last step. Okay. So I'm going to put the words, I'm going to just sing you a little chant as we finish. And we're going to put the words to an old Black spiritual song, Michael Row Your Boat Ashore. I'm going to put them in the chat box. And it's kind of a good way to end, to kind of try and say one kind of last thing here. So Michael Row Your Boat Ashore came from like around the Caribbean, Barbados, from the plantations, right? And Black slaves under horrific conditions, right, had this sense, right, Clyde, that there's a way home. We can row the boat ashore, right? There was a, right, they were able to orient, right? They had the sense that there's a larger sense of cosmos. What we want to do is, I don't want to go back to the old Michael Row Your Boat Ashore. We want to invest Michael Row Your Boat Ashore with new meaning. And ultimately, we've got to rewrite the lyrics. We've got to write a new Michael Row Your Boat Ashore, meaning we receive the inspiration from this Michael Row Your Boat Ashore, right? We sing it, but then we need to rewrite it. We need to tell, right, a new story of hope, right? A young Israeli woman, right, in the Eurovision, and we're not going to go into this now, kind of wrote a beautiful, you know, wild, you know, authentic song of hope, which kind of broke through the polarization and got all these votes in the Eurovision, right, in Europe very beautifully. We'll get to that song at a different time, a different place. But we need to write new hymns. We can't just go back to the old spirituals. We can't just go back to the old lineages, but we have to draw from them and pour new wine into old flasks and create new sculptures, create new art. We can't just go back to Renaissance art. We have to actually create new paintings, right? New art, right? New creativity. And it's only that new creativity which expresses the new story of value and expresses itself in song, right? And in painting, right? And in literature, and actually the telling of the new story, right? The new religare, the new moment of reconnecting, right? The sense of a new religious vision, a new religious vision, which is a context for our diversity, okay? So, oh my God, Michael, row your boat ashore. Michael, row your boat ashore. Hallelujah. And you should be singing by yourself in your own space, but you'll kind of make me from off tune to on tune. I'm counting on that. Michael, row your boat ashore. Hallelujah. Sister, help to trim the sails. Hallelujah. A sister, help to trim the sails. Hallelujah. Michael, row your boat ashore, together around the world. Hallelujah. Michael, row your boat ashore. Hallelujah. The River Jordan is a chilly and cold. Hallelujah. It chills the body, but not the soul. Hallelujah. Michael, row your boat ashore. Hallelujah. Michael, row your boat ashore. Hallelujah.